Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast aimed at better understanding other people and better understanding ourselves. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. On today's episode, I talked to journalist and author Jamie Kirchick about anti-Semitism. In 2017, Kirchick wrote a piece in Commentary magazine titled "The New Jew Hatred, Right and Left." In that piece, he described anti-Semitism coming from both the political right and the left as he saw it. One reason I wanted to talk about this is that anti-Semitism is in the news a lot recently, with Kanye West making anti-Semitic statements and him saying that black people are the real Jews, and with him bringing a strange white supremacist troll over to Trump's house to have dinner together, amongst other strange things he's said and done. Also, not too long ago, Whoopi Goldberg said on the show The View, basically that Hitler and the Nazis trying to commit genocide against the Jewish people was not about race and was a case of white people fighting other white people, essentially. So I wanted to examine some of those things and talk about where some of those ideas come from. Another reason I wanted to do this talk is that I see it as tying into political polarization topics. In the last few weeks, I've seen a lot of liberal side rhetoric about how Trump and Republicans are anti-Semitic, that there's a huge problem on the right with this. And I think a lot of those takes are taking the most pessimistic, worst-case framings one can make. And in doing that, they're adding to our divides. Aren't there, after all, many Jewish conservatives and Trump voters? Wouldn't many people view the Republicans as the more pro-Israel party? What do those people see? Why is it that some people see anti-Semitism as a bigger problem on the left than the right? So I thought talking to Kirchick might give some people some different perspectives on these things. I thought listening to his takes might help us see why some conservatives perceive liberals as rather hysterical on the topic of anti-Semitism, and as also being somewhat hypocritical. And to be clear, you don't have to agree with all of Kirchick's points, but seeing how one can have such views can help us better understand our fellow citizens. As with many of the interviews I do, the value I see is not in reaching some definitive, accurate view on any specific stance. It's not about establishing who's right and who's wrong. There's very few things I myself have confident beliefs about. To me, the value of these talks is in seeing the wide variety of views that rational and well-meaning people can reach on these matters. That seeing of other perspectives is much more important to me than feeling I've got the right views or any specific answers. Because seeing how others can see things differently and examining the nuance present on any specific subject is inherently depolarizing and inherently anger-reducing. Especially when our country is very polarized and we have a tendency to consume simplistic narratives from our preferred bubbles. Not just simplistic narratives of what's right or wrong, but simplistic narratives of what the people on the other side are actually like and what they actually believe. And the more we attempt to see others' points of view, the more sane and respectful and functional our public conversation will become. In this episode, we talk about Trump, we talk about Kanye West, we talk about Whoopi Goldberg's controversial statements. We talk about anti-Semitism on the left and the right. We talk about criticisms of Israel. We talk about George Soros. And we talk about the term globalist and how that word is used, amongst other things. A little bit more about Jamie Kirchick. He's a columnist for Tablet Magazine, a writer at large for Airmail. A widely published journalist, Jamie has reported from over 40 countries, and his reportage, essays, and reviews have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, The Spectator, The Atlantic, The New York Review of Books, and Rolling Stone, amongst many other publications. His first book, The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age, was published by Yale University Press in 2017. In 2022, he had a new book published titled Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington, which was an instant New York Times bestseller. A New York Times review called it a sprawling and enthralling history of how the gay subculture in Washington, D.C., long in shadow, emerged into the clique lights. You can follow Jamie on Twitter at jkirchick. His last name is spelled K-I-R-C-H-I-C-K. A small note here before we start, this podcast does have some ads. If you'd like to support this podcast and get access to ad-free episodes and some other bonus features, please consider subscribing to it. You can learn more about subscribing on my site at behavior-podcast.com/premium. I think the political polarization-related work I've done is important, and also think the topic is not talked about enough in the mainstream. Your subscription will help me spend more time on this podcast and give me resources to promote it more widely. And for a limited time, just until the end of January 2023, those in the US who subscribe for a year will get a free paperback copy of my depolarization book, which is due out in February. Okay, here's the interview with journalist Jamie Kirchick. Hi, Jamie. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe we can start with defining anti-Semitism as you see it. How much of it do you see as a focus on Jewishness as a race versus Jewishness as a religion? Are there other factors you would put in there?
Well, I guess there's very different varieties of it. Judeophobia would probably be a better term for the hatred or bigotry of Jews based on their religious faith. And that probably requires a maybe deeper understanding of Jewish texts and whatnot that I think a lot of people who we would view as anti-Semites might not have. Whereas anti-Semitism, I think, is broadly a racist conception. It's the belief of, it's the hatred of Jews based on their peoplehood, their belief that they constitute a separate and distinct race, and a prejudice against them based upon that. I guess that's how I would define it. It's interesting you ask that question because I feel like we don't see that question asked a lot in these conversations. And I think so much of the reason why this is a controversial topic is because no one ever really defines it. Or it seems that so much of the controversy revolves around, you know, what is and what isn't anti-Semitism.
Right. Yeah. It kind of strikes me in other areas of things where, you know, that can cause big divides. Often there's a failure to even define the concepts we're talking about, like CRT or whatever it is. Mm. Do you see it as maybe hard to define sometimes as because it does overlap so much with these kind of, you know, kind of not even, I don't even think they're thought through these kind of these conspiracy theories of, you know, the Illuminati or these other powerful forces controlling things behind the scenes, which I think people on the far left, far right, whatever political spectrum can have these kind of conspiracy kind of theories. And maybe that helps explain why it can be kind of hard to disentangle sometimes.
Yeah. Well, anti-Semitism is the ultimate conspiracy theory. It's really sort of the oldest one. I mean, if you think of conspiracy theories as being kind of modern phenomenon, I think anti-Semitism is probably the oldest, or the conspiracy theory. And it seems that all the conspiracy theories go back to anti-Semitism. They all basically, you know, if you're talking about shadowy elites, secret people in power orchestrating things from behind a kind of a dark curtain or whatnot, it's hard not to end up with the Jews in some way. And I often find that some people might even be repeating anti-Semitic tropes without often even knowing that they're anti-Semitic. And I do think that there are people who are genuinely surprised when they hear that. They might not even know it. I mean, for instance, the ease with which people, this is separate from conspiracism, but the ease with which people throw around Holocaust analogies, I often think that they're not consciously anti-Semitic. What they're doing is, you know, is in effect anti-Semitic. But I mean, comparing your opponents to Nazis is just something that so many people do these days, right? Or likening the treatment that one suffers, whether it's, you know, under COVID regulations. On the right, you'll see people do that, or people on the left might complain about, you know, police powers, right? Acting like the Gestapo or something. I mean, in both cases, I often think that most people who make these claims don't really realize what they're doing. It's just become such a part of our political vernacular. It's the reducto ad Hitlerum tendency. And oftentimes that can be labeled anti-Semitic, but I'm not really sure it is. It's totally distasteful and inappropriate, and
because it downplays the importance,
it downplays the Holocaust, and it also just raises the stakes in our political discussions to the point where you can't have a civil conversation. I mean, if you're comparing lockdown policies to the Warsaw Ghetto, you know, it's hard to really move on from there and have a meaningful conversation. I don't think that the person making that accusation is anti-Semitic. In fact, often they're putting themselves in the place of the Jews. Right. So if anything, they are trying in their very stupid and ahistorical way to identify with the plight of the Jews. Of course, it's minimizing what the Holocaust was, but I don't think it's right to call those people necessarily anti-Semitic. Some of them might be, but I don't think that that's that that is not what's keeping me awake at night when it comes to anti-Semitism.
Yeah, in your 2017 piece that I read that initially made me contact you, you talked about anti-Semitism as you saw it on the right and the left. And one thing you did, which I thought was really responsible, was giving your opinion about how the United States is actually very Jewish appreciative and how it's not as big a problem as people some people say. And maybe you could give your summary of your opinion of how big a problem do you see it as in the United States, and do you see it as having grown recently?
Yeah, well, a lot's happened in those 5 years. So, but I, you know, in terms of the United States, look, yeah, no country in the world has been better to its Jewish population or better place for Jews to thrive than the United States. And there's really no argument about that, I don't think. Of course, one could argue Israel, right, might be an exception, but that's a special case. And Israel was only created in 1948. But Jews have prospered in the United States like nowhere else. If you just look at how successful they've been in professions, in culture, in politics, and philanthropy, in just becoming a part of the American tapestry. There's obviously anti-Semitism in America, and there has been. I mean, you know, it was not that long ago that Jews were victimized by quotas, right? You couldn't get into there. There was a limit placed on the number of Jews who were allowed into elite schools and universities, and there were neighborhoods that were not open to Jews. But this pales in comparison to what Jews had to suffer pretty much anywhere else in the world. Certainly, from the countries where most American Jews trace their lineage, which is Europe. And Jews came to America for good reasons. They were subjected to all sorts of discrimination and second-class citizenship, and worse, obviously, in places like the former Soviet Union, Russia, Imperial Russia. So they came to America seeking a better life, and they achieved it. And I feel enormously, you know, fortunate to have been an American Jew born in 1983. I mean, there's really no better. It's really kind of a golden age. So that article was published in 2017. I do think things have gotten worse for Jews, not nearly to the point where anyone should be thinking about packing their bags. But Donald Trump obviously, you know, unleashed a lot of ugly things in this country. And I'm going to say this. I don't think he is himself an anti-Semite. He's remarkable. And I say that even knowing this is, we're recording this podcast a week or two after he sat down to lunch with, or dinner with Kanye West and Nick Fuentes. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's because he's an anti-Semite. I think his vanity and his narcissism is, you know, world historical, that he'll break bread with people who flatter him. I mean, that's really what even if they're Nazis, like that's how pathetic this guy is, right? He's not doing this because he seeks to, you know, hurt Jews. I mean, his daughter is Jewish. He has Jewish grandchildren. I don't believe that he is himself an anti-Semite. It's not excusing his behavior. It's reprehensible. And the man, you know, clearly, you know, has no business being dog catcher, let alone president of the United States. But put that aside, whether he is or isn't an anti-Semite, I find it a kind of waste of time. And this is something that, you know, whatever I say, I'm going to get attacked by the people who hate him and think he's Hitler, or I'm going to get attacked by the Trump supporters who think he's done better things for the Jews than, you know, Cyrus the Great. It's indisputable that a lot of far-right, legitimate, open, proud anti-Semites flock to him and like him. And I saw that in 2015 when he was running for president. I wrote an article, which I still stand by. I said, Donald Trump is the candidate of the mob, and the mob always comes for the Jews. He is the candidate of conspiracy theories. He's the candidate of mindless populism. Populism in itself is not necessarily always bad. There are good aspects of populism. I don't think he represented a lot of bad aspects of populism. So he kind of opened a Pandora's box, and a lot of nasty shit came out. And I hold him responsible for that. And I've held him responsible for that before he had dinner with Kanye West and Nick Fuentes.
Yeah, before we move on from that, one thing about that dinner, the Kanye dinner, I mean, I'm with you in the sense that I really think if anybody flattered Trump,
really flattered him. He would basically do, you know, anything they want, really. And I think, you know, people underestimate how easy it would be for Kanye to be like, hey, Trump, I really want to have dinner with you, and I'm bringing this guy, and, you know, and not even maybe tell him until they got there. I mean, there's just all sorts of ways this can play out. And I think Trump is so desperate to also to appeal to the black vote and such too. He would probably have done many things that Kanye asked him to do. And
yeah.
So I think people underestimate those kinds of factors. Like you say, his ego and the flattery, how far flattery gets people with him, these kinds of things.
Yeah. I said from the beginning, Trump isn't a fascist. He's a golfer. And it's just reading him incorrectly to, you know, imagine this kind of devious plan. Mm-hmm.
Well, and sort of like you say too, the liberal, like we're saying with the Holocaust, people making Holocaust analogies. Mm. And I think the analogies of that Trump is this raving anti-Semite or this racist in general, these exaggerated claims don't help. You know, there's plenty of things to actually focus on that we legitimately know. And the more exaggerated claims just rile up the tensions and kind of, to me, they create the very things we're angry about.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think our country has suffered a lot because of not only Donald Trump, but the way in which he's been able to validate, in which the left has basically used him to validate their own transgressions, right? And their own overreach and their own illiberal behavior. And we could look at what's going on with Twitter right now and, you know, what's being revealed now, that Twitter was basically running censorship campaigns against conservatives for years. And they did that because Donald Trump existed. And Donald Trump's existence has basically been used by the left to validate all sorts of things that I think are destructive and bad for our country. But that's a separate podcast, probably. But I will say, so there's been the right, and there's been absolutely a marked increase in anti-Semitic activity and the prominence of anti-Semites on the right with the rise of the alt-right and just with the whole kind of Donald Trump gestalt. It's been bad for the Jews. And I say that in spite of what I do think are some really important geopolitical advances that he made with the Abraham Accords. Great. You know, with recognizing Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. Great. With pushing back on Iran and reneging on the Iran deal and killing Qasem Soleimani. Also great. I don't believe that just because I'm pro-Israel that I therefore have to praise Donald Trump as a wonderful person. I can hold two ideas in my head. And a lot of conservative Trump-supporting Jews don't seem to agree with me. They think that because he did these wonderful things for Israel, you have to shut up and praise him as the best, you know, the best president ever for Jews, or maybe since Harry Truman recognized the state of Israel. And I just don't buy that. I don't buy that when it comes to anything political. I think for myself, and I'm able to criticize and compliment at the same time. That shouldn't be difficult for people, but it too often is today, unfortunately. And then there's also, of course, there's been increasing anti-Semitism on the left. We now have, really for the first time, a kind of a small but very vocal anti-Semitic caucus in the House of Representatives among the squad. You know, we're talking about a handful of representatives, but they, you know, regularly make anti-Semitic statements. And that is not something that's really existed in living memory, for me at least. And it's really hard to remember when that happened. And the kind of the spinelessness of Democratic leaders to really condemn and call this out. There have been Democrats who have called out Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and there's a few others. But it's been mostly crickets, and that's disappointing. Of course, and then the anti-Semitism on campuses, which just gets, you know, worse and worse every year, and the stories just pile up. You can't even keep track of them with all the sorts of boycotts and cancellations, anti-Semitism under the guise of anti-Zionism. I mean, I think there isn't a distinction between the two. I think they are one and the same, and we can talk about that if you want. But on the left, you see it. It's less. The left-wing anti-Semitism I find more insidious and obnoxious because at least the right-wing anti-Semites tell you as Jews that they hate you. They're very open about it and unapologetic. I mean, they, you know, when I was criticizing Donald Trump in 2016, I would get all sorts of blatantly anti-Semitic messages on Twitter, in my email, on Facebook. people, you know, doctoring cartoons with me in a gas chamber and Donald Trump pulling the lever, lots of Pepe the Frog tweets, all that kind of crap. Whereas with the left, it's always this very erudite, you know, of course we don't hate Jews. You know, hating anyone is not, we don't hate anyone. That's something that only right-wingers do, that knuckle-dragging right-wingers hate people. We just oppose this, you know, racist colonialist occupier. And its supporters in America who have dual loyalties, who aren't really loyal to this country. They're Israel firsters and whatnot. So that's how left-wing anti-Semitism carries itself. And there's a third form of anti-Semitism, which frankly we don't see that much in the United States. And that's the Islamic kind or the Islamist kind. That's much more prevalent in Europe, where they have, you know, it depends on the country, but if you're looking at France, for instance, and England to an extent, you know, large, not well assimilated Muslim communities who they basically imported this anti-Semitism from the Arab Muslim world. And that's why you see these, you know, the Jewish institutions and Jewish leaders and whatnot living under, you know, armed protection, which unfortunately is actually increasingly happening in the United States now too, that Jewish institutions in the United States, synagogues, Jewish day schools and whatnot, are also getting, you know, armed security, which is a really unfortunate development, but a necessary one.
Getting back to the liberal side, academic anti-Semitism, as you see it, you also talked about the kind of seeing Jews as white or white adjacent kind of views too, which I think that's maybe a separate category, subcategory maybe, or related to some of the campus anti-Semitism as you viewed it. But maybe you can describe a little bit of that argument.
Yeah. So as American discourse in society becomes, or the salience of race is becoming, it's increasing in our conversation. I actually think it matters less and less, like, right? Like in terms of your life chances, in terms of your economic station, in terms of, you know, the kind of everyday discrimination one faces as an American, I actually think race is less salient. You know, there's more intermarriage, right? The black middle class is growing. You know, the number of actual like police shootings of unarmed black men has actually gone down. Okay. Like all those statistics, I think are moving in the right direction. Unfortunately, we have this intellectual conversation and this discourse where race seems like it's never been more prevalent. And there's this new, these new terms, intersectionality, which is basically, you know, inverting a racial hierarchy with whites at the bottom and, you know, non-whites at the top. And there's various levels of, you know, even within that non-white category, there's a hierarchy, you know, and it's unclear where Asians lie in this, right? Like Asians are considered white adjacent, according to some woke people. Hispanics are also dangerously becoming white adjacent. And that's purely based on the fact that they're increasingly voting for Republicans. It has nothing to do with anything else but that fact. And so because we have this discourse now where, you know, whiteness and whites and white people are considered all to be inherently racist, they all carry implicit bias, they are all responsible for the historical injustices that were committed by, you know, white people of generations before, they've inherited this guilt. To say that Jews are white and to constantly make this point over and over again, that Jews are complicit with whiteness. While I agree that I, as an Ashkenazi Jew, you know, I present as white, yes, I am not going to be stopped by a police officer for driving while black, right? Like that's, I'm not going to suffer from that kind of discrimination. Okay. I'm not going to be followed around in a department store by a sales clerk in the way that, you know, black people often wrongly are. I'm not going to suffer that. But that's not the purpose of what this discourse is, I think. I think this constant harping on white Jews this, white Jews that, is to basically, you know, rob Jews of any kind of minority status, any kind of history that they've endured of past oppression and suffering and discrimination, and to just group them with this bad group. The bad group is the whites, you know, with a capital W. And so I see it as a very kind of provocative, hostile act, frankly, that is meant to divide. It is meant to demonize Jews. It is meant to identify them as part of an oppressor class. And I think that it is in some sense anti-Semitic. Yeah, I do.
One of the things that seems to play a role there is this kind of binary view that differences in racial outcomes are solely due to racism. It almost seems like there's this binary, which leaves a lot of the factors that can be involved out of the picture, you know, like what happened in the past and how that.
Yeah. And what's the flip side of that, right? If Jews are so successful, far beyond their 2% of the population, right? How do we explain that, you know, at one point, like a third of Yale was Jewish, right? And the Ivy League schools were disproportionately Jewish. And listen to what Yi is saying, right? Or listen to what people say about Hollywood or the publishing industry. Or any, what can that mean? It can only mean that if the disparate outcomes are only explainable by these invidious explanations, then it must mean that the Jews must have done something wrong to get to where they are. Mm-hmm. They must have cheated out other people, right? How else can we explain this enormous, you know, disproportionate presence of Jews in certain institutions, in certain professions? So yeah, the whole equity agenda, I think, is anti-Semitic and racist, but particularly anti-Semitic, because there is no group that I think has a more disproportionate presence, where the difference between their percentage of the population and their presence in certain institutions is more disproportionate than Jews. Mm-hmm. There is. It's true. There are a lot of Jews in Hollywood. Yeah, there are. Why is that? Is it because that they're all, you know, meeting on Friday nights to kind of help each other out? Is there some sort of surreptitious, nefarious agenda going on? Or are there other explanations for it? I mean, why is the NBA so heavily African-American? You know, like, not everything has some kind of evil, nefarious explanation behind it. But when you argue that there is, and that, as you know, the Ibram X. Kendi's of the world say, that, you know, unless, I mean, he basically says that every institution, every outcome has to be almost exactly proportionate to, right? Isn't that what he's basically saying? So that is, that's arguing for a return to quotas. That's arguing for a return to the 1940s, at least for Jews it is. It's arguing for a return to the 1940s when the number of Jews in institutions there was a ceiling placed on that. And I mean, that's not something, I mean, that's anti-Semitism. I don't know what else to call that. And now it's anti-Asian.
Right. I think it gets back to this whole concept, which I think is driving a lot of this, is that any differences in outcome are due to racism or white supremacy. And it's just, there's so many factors. I mean, you can believe that Black people and other groups have had a hard time, and that has affected them in many ways. Just like, for example, you know, Appalachian coal miners can have a hard time, and we don't, you know, we don't say it's because they're lacking in some fundamental way. We can just recognize that there's all these factors present. But to boil it all down to, you know, there's racism in the society to explain these things is just such a simplification, and that makes people look for, you know, where's the racism? It must be coming from these, you know, the people that are perceived as having more power and are the oppressors and stuff. And, yes. And that creates its own animosity.
A note here, these are hard things to talk about in passing, as it's easy to misstate people's stances and easy for people talking about these things to be misunderstood. If you want to do your own research into these topics more, I'd recommend a few books. Ibram X. Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, is where many of the most prominent anti-racism ideas come from. So that's probably the key book for understanding some of the most common anti-racism arguments. And then as a rejoinder to that, you could read John McWhorter's Woke Racism, which goes through various criticisms of those types of ideas and makes the argument that many of the anti-racism arguments are simplistic and divisive. And another book that might be pertinent to the topic of this episode is David Bernstein's book Woke Anti-Semitism, which is similar to John McWhorter's book, but from a Jewish perspective. Okay, back to the talk.
I want to get back to your views on Kanye West and what Whoopi Goldberg said on The View and some things like that. But one thing you said that I wanted to focus on more, which I think you know, of all the things you've said, is probably something that many liberals would might find fault with, is when it comes to criticism of Israel, how do you draw the line between what is, you know, valid criticism that anyone can make about a country or anybody doing bad things as they see it versus anti-Semitism?
I think I have a pretty strict definition of this. I don't think that, you know, there are some people who would say, you know, the criticizing Israel for actions that you wouldn't criticize another country of or another democracy of. A lot of defenders of Israel would say that that's anti-Semitic. And I'm not willing to go that far. I think there are lots of people, and they might be misguided, but they do hold Israel to a higher standard. And that's not always necessarily anti-Semitic. I mean, there are many Jews, most Jews I know would hold Israel to a higher standard. They expect more of Israel than they do of, you know, even Britain or France or other exemplary, you know, human rights respecting democracies. And it pains them that Israel is often in these situations, you know, due to its geography and its history, where it is engaged in, you know, constant military activity. I mean, it's been militarily occupying, you know, a large population of Arabs since 1967 for 55 years. That's a long time. So it's going to do things that a country does when it's engaged in military actions, and there are always going to be mistakes. There are always going to be innocent people who are harmed, and there's occasionally going to be atrocities. You know, I mean, even great democracies commit atrocities because humans are infallible and they make mistakes. And everyone is capable of evil. Every individual is capable of evil, and a country is no more than the sum of its citizens. And I don't sit here and claim that, you know, Israelis or Jews are any more, you know, moral as individuals than any other people. What I would say is that I think the sort of obsessive criticism of Israel that we see in some quarters, mostly on the left, the obsession with Israel, with this relatively small country, I think assigning to it, you know, describing it in almost demonic fashion. If you're comparing, again, this is actually where I would say that Hitler and Nazi comparisons are anti-Semitic. If you are comparing the actions of the Jewish state to what the Nazis did to the Jews, you are at the very least, you are being extremely insensitive and, you know, provocative, unnecessarily provocative. At the very least, I would say that that's anti-Semitism. I mean, to compare the treatment of the Palestinians, or even the citizens of the Gaza Strip to, you know, the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. There are lots of things that you could say about how the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip are treated. To deliberately choose that comparison, right, that analogy, that I would say is anti-Semitic. I think singling out Israel is also anti-Semitic, right? So like when you look at the amount of time that is spent at the United Nations on Israel in the human rights committees, where there are real egregious abusers of human rights, Cuba, North Korea, it's a joke, you know, for those countries, for the Arab world, by the way, okay? There's no Arab Muslim country which can hold a candle to Israel when it comes to not only, you know, rule of law, democracy, freedom of speech and whatnot, but the treatment of its minority citizens. I mean, Arabs in Israel are treated better than Arabs in any Arab-ruled country, right? So to single Israel out, I'm not saying to criticize Israel, I'm saying the singling out of Israel, right? The boycotting of Israel, the fact that Israel is targeted, is the subject of more resolutions in these committees, the fact that you have these academics who choose only to boycott Israel, right? If they were so concerned with human rights, there are lots of other countries in the world that are much, much worse in terms of their human rights practices than Israel. I mean, there's no argument about that, right? So when you see a group of academics in Britain decide that they're going to boycott Israeli scholars, that to me is blatant anti-Semitism. What else is it that's making them choose this country that just happens to be the world's only Jewish country? Why else are they doing it? I think that's de facto anti-Semitism, right? So singling out Israel. If Israel's doing something singularly bad, fine, then you can single them out. But they're not. Okay, at least in these conversations about human rights practices and whatnot. So that, I think, is anti-Semitic. But I think, I mean, look, Israel has a very vigorous free press, and you can read extremely critical things of all aspects of Israeli government and society and culture in the Israeli press. And you can talk, any Israeli would, you know, there's the old joke, you know, two Jews, three opinions. It's even more pronounced in Israel. So it has a very vibrant civil society where all sorts of criticisms are aired. And by the way, you know, Israelis love to throw Nazi analogies back and forth at each other, okay? And maybe there's a kind of special dispensation we can give them because they're Jews, and that's whatever. That's where I would say the legitimate criticism of Israel crosses the line into anti-Semitism.
Do you think some of these things kind of have a kind of a feedback mechanism of once they get started, it's hard to stop them in the sense that, you know, there can be elements of peer pressure, of people just not being aware of the complexity of Israel? That's one thing that strikes me there is when I've tried to dig into the things that have happened in Israel and what the narratives really were. It's really hard to, it would take me a lifetime of research to really feel I understood it. But yet people have these like simplistic ideas of like, oh, look what's happening over there. Something bad happened. Israel must be at fault, and leaving out all the context of, you know, the history and what led up to that. So I'm curious if you see some of these things kind of having a life of their own once they get into these established and people, you know, are like, oh, they're saying this, I'll say it too, kind of thing.
Yes, I do think there's a lot of peer pressure, particularly among young people on college campuses and in certain spaces, right, where it's very fashionable to embrace the cause of the underdog. And, you know, for the first 25 years of its existence, or 20 years, you could say, until 1967, really, Israel was the underdog, and Israel had the support of the global left. It had the support of the Soviet Union in 1948. And it had the support of most, you know, socialists and other people on the left around the world. And that began to change in 1967 once Israel won a defensive war that was waged by its Arab neighbors to destroy it, and found itself in possession and in control of territories where Palestinians were residing, right? And that's how the occupation began. And so, yes, Israel is absolutely, of course, responsible for the way it treats the citizens under its control in those territories. But I do believe that there's a level of complexity to this conversation that many of Israel's critics don't appreciate. Or many, I should say, the ones who sort of joined the bandwagon, right? The ones who would post memes of, you know, likening Palestinian children to children in the Warsaw Ghetto. I don't think that those people who do that are really historically aware. And I think that they're often, I mean, the people who are liking those posts on Facebook are ignorant. The ones who are posting and the ones who are actively spreading those memes and those messages, I think, are anti-Semites.
So maybe we can go to some specific instances. For example, when Whoopi Goldberg on The View basically said that the Holocaust was basically white people fighting with themselves when it came to Jewish people being killed in World War II. And maybe you could talk about how you see that as playing into some of the liberal side philosophies, arguments about race and seeing Jewish people as white, things like that.
Yeah, again, I think it's partly ignorance, and it's partly this very American-centric view of the world where, you know, our main cleavage is the race question. That's the main societal cleavage in this country. And it's taking that prism, the kind of white versus non-white, or black, you know, the black and white issue in the United States, and thinking that every other issue in the world should be seen through that prism. And that's just wrong. I mean, again, this would sound sort of, maybe I'm playing into it by talking like this way, but like, you know, the Jews were like the blacks of Nazi Germany, okay? If that helps Whoopi Goldberg understand. It's like, yes, they had the same skin tone as Aryan, or however they called themselves, right? As in terms of, you know, the master race, They had the same skin tone, okay, but they were not viewed the same way, and they were not treated the same way, clearly, because 6 million of them were murdered. And by the way, they viewed other, they viewed Eastern Europeans and Slavs as subhuman races. They looked, again, if you held up their hands, the hand of a German and that of a Pole or a Slovak or a Romanian or a Russian, their skin tone would be the same, Whoopi. But that's not how the Nazis viewed things. So was she acting from some kind of deeply thought anti-Semitic impulse? I don't think so. I think she's just extremely ignorant. And it's also very self-centered, right? It's this belief that the world revolves around the America and the American race issue. Mm-hmm. And I'll just give another example of this in a kind of a different context. I was at a dinner a couple nights ago with a group of Ukrainian members of parliament who were visiting from Ukraine. And it was a dinner with a group of American journalists. And the whole night, everyone was talking about, it was mostly these young women, they were all women, and they were sort of presenting their case and what their country's been going through with the Russian invasion and how terrible it's been. And at the end, there was a someone at the dinner table, we all sort of gave our kind of two-minute spiel. And there was one young man who got up and said that the story, he could relate to it as an African-American, because African-Americans are fighting the same sort of existential struggle for their survival that you Ukrainian people are. And I'm just thinking to myself, I'm like, come on. Like, these women are, they're in a country right now where apartment buildings are being blown to bits from the sky by Russian bombers. Like, literally, there's a campaign of genocide is arguable. Okay, it's arguable that the Russians are committing genocide in Ukraine right now. I don't know what the latest death toll is. It's in the tens of thousands, if not higher. And you listen to Vladimir Putin, he sounds Hitlerian in the way he talks about Ukrainians. Okay, this is a made up country, and it needs to cease to exist. He's sounding like Hitler talking about the peoples to his east, or the Jews for that matter. You know, to compare the plight of what Ukrainians are going through right now with that of African Americans, I think is just, again, it's minimizing what Ukrainians are going through. And it's also just incredibly self-centered. Like, not everything revolves around the American racial issue. And not everything should be seen through that prism.
Yeah, I think there's so many of these simplistic narratives that, as you say, seldom get challenged, you know, in these us versus them narratives.
Of course, no one in that room, by the way, a couple nights ago, it was a very fancy restaurant in Washington, D.C. You know, I could maybe suspect that other people agreed with me that this was an absurd thing to be saying and almost insulting to the women who were there. But of course, no one was going to pipe up and say, hey, you know what? This is kind of a stupid comparison. This is a really stupid and shallow analogy. Maybe you shouldn't be making it and you're insulting our guests. Of course, no one's going to say that. And there are a whole lot of things that people don't say when it comes to these sorts of issues.
I'm somebody who works on depolarization. And one of my big beliefs is that we all need to speak up more when we hear unhelpful and divisive, you know, narratives and viewpoints on our side, specifically on our side. But that's the nature of polarization that makes people unlikely to challenge people on their side. And that's like the very way it works, is just people are unwilling to challenge things on their side. So their side becomes more and more unreasonable, et cetera. When it comes to Kanye, I'm curious what you think, and I'll give my brief thing and you can maybe play off of that. Is I see Kanye as having, I think he has like some personality disorders. Clearly. Disorder in the way he behaves, but I can also see that, you know, some of his views are, he's also like imbibing through the culture on like the far left and far right, in my opinion, of in various ways, and just kind of swimming in these like weird waters, and he's saying weird things because he's got some sort of some issues. But I'm curious what your take on it is.
Well, look, I'm not a psychiatrist, but I do think he clearly has some sort of mental problem. I've heard, you know, bipolarism mentioned. And so I don't know how much we can attribute to that.
A small note here. If you're interested in the connection between mental health and saying offensive things, I've examined that in some previous episodes. The reason I delved into that topic previously was that I saw a lot of liberal side overreactions to various viral videos of people
who were saying racist or offensive things. And some of these people were quite clearly suffering from mental issues. At one point, there was even a protest staged in California based on the ravings of a clearly mentally unwell woman. And on the left, even now with Kanye, there is often a framing that having mental problems or personality disorders aren't a factor in people saying antisocial or racist things. And this is clearly not true. Some mental issues or personality disorders will result in people saying horrible antisocial things. If you're interested to learn more about that, check out those previous episodes. One was titled Factors Involved in Offensive Speech, and another one was a talk with Rob Tarswell about his emergency room psychiatric work. Okay, back to the talk.
In terms of the content of what he's saying, look, it's coming really heavily from, it's not the far left. It's coming from, sorry, it's not really the far left or the far right. It's coming, it's Louis Farrakhan. It's black nationalism. And this is kind of the elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about, right? Which is the prevalence of anti-Semitic thinking among African Americans. It's higher than among the general population, significantly so. You know, I just saw a poll that said only 44% of African Americans responded yes when asked if Kanye West's remarks are anti-Semitic, which means that a majority either don't know or do not think that what he said was anti-Semitic. But in terms of the content of what he's saying, like the Jews who claim to be Jews are fake Jews, you know, blacks are the real Jews. That's the black Hebrews. Your listeners might not know this, but there was the largest anti-Semitic demonstration since Charlottesville, happened just a couple of weeks ago in Brooklyn, with, I don't know, 200 or 300 black Hebrews were marching in support of Kyrie Irving, another very prominent black celebrity who's made, you know, blatantly anti-Semitic remarks. That was not covered in the media, right? Like, we're still hearing about Charlottesville, okay? 5 years after it happened. It's, we hear about that a lot. It's very much imprinted upon the American mind, and rightly so. But, you know, there was hardly any coverage of a similar-sized anti-Semitic demonstration because the people who were, you know, the villains in this story, it's inconvenient, right? And so the mainstream media and basically our sense-making institutions and the culture, you know, academia, all these institutions, they don't want to confront this. And that's why you just don't really hear about it, because it's a very inconvenient and uncomfortable topic to discuss.
And a good number of hate crimes and even murders of Jewish people have been by, you know, the black Hebrew Israelite type of people. Is that true?
Yeah, or just random assailants. I mean, you look at New York City, where, you know, I'm not visibly Jewish. I'm not Orthodox. I'm not wearing a yarmulke. I'm not wearing, long sideburns, payas. But among that segment of the Jewish population, yeah, it's quite dangerous. And there's been a huge spike in violence against them. And it's almost exclusively from African-Americans, you know, non-white assailants, basically, are the main perpetrators of that violence. And again, that's a subject that you will not really see covered outside of the Jewish press and the conservative press. It's just something that the mainstream media does not want to touch, because it doesn't fit into this narrative that they've been crafting since 2015, 2016, right? That the rise of Donald Trump and white supremacy is the central evil of our time. And you've even seen this when there was this spate of anti-Asian attacks about 2 years ago, much if not the majority of it also perpetrated by African Americans. We were being told that this was the fault of white supremacy. And there was no logical, people were saying this in full view. There was video evidence of these attacks that were happening, and yet they would constantly say that it's still, I don't even know how they rationalized it, that this was still somehow the fault of white supremacy.
So another example that often is brought up of anti-Semitism is the George Soros memes and insults and such. And in my own research of delving into some of the darker parts of the internet, I went into some pro-Trump Facebook groups, and interestingly to me, or surprisingly maybe to me, the amount of hate that I saw for George Soros was just off the charts compared to other people. You know, like Hillary Clinton and Obama and all these people got a lot of hate too, but the amount of kind of visceral, you know, death wishes and this kind of thing were just kind of off the charts for George Soros. And I'm curious how much of the
anti-George Soros speech and language and rhetoric from conservatives do you view as anti-Semitic? Because in some ways I can see some of it as being similar, you know, to what we talked about with criticism of Israel, where some of the people doing this would not view, you know, they view it as like, oh, there's a powerful person with money giving money to liberal causes, so I hate them kind of thing. But I'm curious what your take on where you see the boundaries of that is, or how much of it do you see as being anti-Semitic?
Well, I'm not a fan of really vitriolic, hateful, unhinged criticism and commentary in general. So I don't like it. When it comes to George Soros, look, the man is the biggest funder of the Democratic Party, and he has been, and generally of liberal progressive causes. It should be fair to criticize him. And I think, you know, liberals and progressives, many of whom are very quick, by the way, to deny any anti-Semitism in their own ranks, and are very quick to defend people whom I consider to be anti-Semites, like Ilhan Omar. They get very, very, very sensitive about criticizing George Soros, who, by the way, does not really even identify as Jewish. I mean, he's been open about that. He identifies as a Jew, but he doesn't give any money to Jewish philanthropies, any causes. He's very much sees himself as a citizen of the world. He's a cosmopolitan. He kind of despises what he views as this kind of like grubby particularism of Jews. But that's, you know, that's his decision. And that doesn't mean that he should therefore be subjected to, you know, anti-Semitic attacks. But it is an interesting kind of side note. But, you know, when Marco Rubio or other conservatives criticize, or they use the term, you know, Soros-backed prosecutors to describe some of these progressive, very left-wing prosecutors in various cities across the country who are, you know, letting criminals out of jail and not prosecuting them for various crimes or reducing their sentences, removing cash bail and whatnot. When they refer to these individuals as Soros-backed prosecutors, there was a huge controversy about this in August, and this was deemed anti-Semitic. You know, merely to point out the fact that George Soros is funding, to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, prosecutors who are public officials, right, who are pursuing very controversial policies. That, to me, is ridiculous. The terms, look, if George Soros is being discussed in terms that are the same that the left uses to describe the Koch brothers, then I don't see how that can be anti-Semitic. And by the way, they're describing the Koch brothers as, you know, these shadowy actors who are destroying the country and whatnot. And that's fine. That's political rhetoric. They're allowed to do that. I don't think that when people on the right, or not just the right, when other people criticize George Soros in similar fashion, that it is ipso facto an example of anti-Semitism. In the United States, that is, okay? I think that it's a somewhat different conversation when you're talking about Hungary, which has a different history than the United States in a very different context. And there's a very different relationship, between, you know, the Jews and that government and, you know, Jews and non-Jews in Hungary. This is a country that largely collaborated in the extinction of its own Jewish population during the Holocaust. And when the leaders of that country decide to make George Soros this, you know, Emmanuel Goldstein-type boogeyman, when Viktor Orban gives a speech and he says that the country's enemies are not loyal, they're not patriotic, they speculate with money, they're internationalists, they're globalists, to me, that's crossing a line. Because there is a baggage and there is a context and there's a history in Hungary that, you know, getting back to where this conversation started, is not the history of the United States, and is in many ways the opposite of the history of the United States. It's the reason why Jews left places like Hungary in the last century and even earlier to come to the United States. So I think there's a kind of naivete among a lot of American right wingers and conservatives. You actually ask them, a lot of them don't even know he's Jewish. And I'm not like trying to play defense for the right here, because there are some people on the right who know exactly what they're doing. Right, they know exactly that they're playing into Jewish tropes, and they use those anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic tropes. But there are lots of conservatives who, you know, they're just watching Fox News or they're listening to talk radio, and yeah, George Soros is the biggest donor to the Democrats and progressive causes. Of course, they're not going to like him, mm-hmm. And they use intemperate language to describe him. But you know what? Like, I don't see liberals being very nice when they talk about Mitch McConnell or the Koch brothers or Peter Thiel or the big bad boogeymen who write checks to conservative causes, right? So, you know, I'd like it if we were all a little more restrained in how we talk about our fellow Americans, right? But in the absence of that, I'm not so quick to just rush and say that any intemperate criticism of George Soros, even saying that he's evil, okay, that's not necessarily anti-Semitic.
Another thing you made me think of is the focus on the word globalist, and some people treat that as code for Jewish. I've seen that a lot, and I'm honestly kind of perplexed by that sometimes, because I was reading, you know, back in the day, I read Jerry Mander's book, The Case Against Globalism, like early on, and he's Jewish. And I just wonder how you see that word being used.
I think it can be. It depends on the context, right? All this stuff is contextual. Mm-hmm. And I think
it's complex.
That,
yeah.
Yeah. Well, you say no question, but a lot of people don't see it that way, right? And they make these categorical judgments, and they're not willing to abide any nuance or apply it in a case-by-case basis. I mean, I first came across the term globalist when I was researching the Ron Paul newsletters, which was a story that I broke for the New Republic in 2008. Ron Paul published all these newsletters dating back to the 1970s, where, you know, he was railing against his usual bugbears, like, you know, fiat money and the Federal Reserve and big budgets, big government spending, deficit spending. But there was also a lot of kind of right-wing pro-militia, racist conspiracy theory stuff in there too. And he was using this word globalist a lot. And then I looked into it more, and it seemed that it was really kind of popularized with the John Birch Society, which was a far right, it still exists, was founded as a far right anti-communist organization, and definitely was anti-Semitic. And William F. Buckley Jr. sort of famously kicked them out of the conservative movement in the early 1960s, if you will. So the word definitely has anti-Semitic intonations, associations, if you will, but it is not always and everywhere. So I think that if you're talking against, you know, free trade deals and international agreements, and you want the United States out of the United Nations, and you want the United States out of NATO, you know, come home, America, and you're just a kind of isolationist, you know, have isolationists been anti-Semitic in the past? Yeah, Charles Lindbergh, the leader of the America First movement, was an anti-Semite. But not everyone in the America First movement was anti-Semitic. And I don't think that someone who opposes international trade deals or American involvement in the world is necessarily anti-Semitic. There's a lot of overlap, because it often comes back to, well, why is it that the United States has these big defense budgets and is involved in all these wars and international conflicts? It's because they're trying to support or defend the state of Israel. And why are they supporting or defending the state of Israel? Oh, it's because of these neocons in Washington with all their money. So that's why there's a lot of overlap between the isolationist community and the anti-Semitic community. Mm-hmm. But I have friends who are more libertarian inclined, who, you know, just don't believe that the United States should play a kind of global leadership role, and they want out of all these institutions. And they're not anti-Semitic, and they're not driven to this position because they have some kind of conspiratorial view of what the Israel lobby is kind of hoodwinking the American people. They don't share that. And so, yeah, I mean, it's, again, there's context, and, you know, sometimes globalist can be used in an anti-Semitic context, sometimes not. I don't think Donald Trump, or necessarily even Steve Bannon, who was the one, I think Bannon was the one who really kind of inserted that word into Trump's speeches and whatnot. I don't think that they were, that they're being motivated by an anti-Semitic impulse there. I think it is just this genuine kind of American nationalism that has a very long pedigree in this country. You can trace it all the way back to Andrew Jackson, and maybe even earlier. And, you know, these guys would say that they trace it all the way back to George Washington, right, who opposed entangling alliances with other countries. Mm-hmm. So this is a real aspect of American foreign policy thinking. And while it has attracted anti-Semites under its banner, it is not inherently anti-Semitic.
One question I've sometimes wondered is, do you think that Jewish peoples not believing in an afterlife is a factor in them seeming to, as a group, be very hard workers?
It is a good question. And I'm not a very religious Jew, so I'm probably not the right person to be asking. But I have gotten the sense, just growing up, and I mean, I was, you know, I am a Jew, and I was bar mitzvahed, and I had a kind of somewhat Jewish education, you know, growing up, but very much culturally Jewish, you could say. And I definitely got the impression that there was this sense that, you know, like the Catholic kids could go confess whenever they committed a sin. They could go confess and get absolved by the priest. And there was this afterlife, right? That's what ultimately, as Christians, that they were ultimately striving for was a place in this afterlife. Mm-hmm. And like that didn't, we didn't get any of that. You know, like that's not how Jews lived. It's like, it's the here, it's like, you know, there's this world and you gotta make this world better and you have to succeed in this world and you have to treat people good in this world. And you can't keep on committing a sin every week and getting absolved and going back and doing it again. So I think there was this kind of cultural sense that maybe the Christians had it easier, right? Maybe non-Jews. I don't know about the Muslim tradition here or other religious traditions, but you know, growing up in America, Christianity is obviously the predominant culture. And yeah, and just this sense that you know, we didn't believe in a heaven. Like that was not, you don't hear that in synagogue, that you know, all this talk about the afterlife and trying to win a place in heaven. It's just not kind of was not a part of my like Jewish upbringing. Mm-hmm. You know, whether or not, you know, that has on a larger scale, whether or not that has anything to do with, you know, Jewish success. I definitely think it has a lot to do with sort of the Jewish philanthropic drive, the Jewish priority on learning. You know, you just see the enormous amount of support that, you know, Jewish philanthropies and charities, what they do, individual Jews, right? Extremely philanthropic with non-Jewish causes too, right? I mean, look, David Geffen's name is everywhere, right? There's all these Jewish philanthropists. I think it does have something to do with that. Yes.
Yeah. It's just interesting to me because it's something I've often wondered and I've just never seen anything written about it. And I kind of wondered if it might be viewed as insensitive to talk about, but it just seems to me like,
no.
Like you say, it's, you know, it's, I want to get my rewards in this life. I don't have a second life to fall back on. I have here and now, you know?
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair question to ask.
Do you want to mention anything else? Maybe anything that you thought we missed or else go into what you're working on these days?
Well, I published a book this past summer, which doesn't really have anything to do with what we talked about today, but it's about another minority. It's called Secret City, The Hidden History of Gay Washington. And it's about the role of homosexuality in American high politics from World War II to the end of the Cold War, when to be a homosexual in Washington was really the most dangerous thing you could possibly be, even more dangerous than being a communist. And that book was published in the summer. It was a New York Times bestseller. It was just named to the list of the top 100 notable books of the year by the Times. And I am back to journalism, writing for Tablet and Airmail and Quillette and other places that I write for, and thinking about a next book, but not settled on one yet.
Congrats on the book success.
Thank
That's
you.
Great. And yeah, and thanks a lot for coming on and thanks for giving your opinions.
Thanks for having me.
That was journalist and author Jamie Kirchick. You can learn more about him on his website, jameskirchick.com. You can follow him on Twitter at jkirchick. I wanted to mention some people and resources who contributed to my research for this episode. I read some of David Bernstein's book, Woke Antisemitism, which makes the case that some common liberal side anti-racism approaches are divisive and can lead to anti-Semitic views. Bernstein has long been an influential person in Jewish organizations, and he shares his experiences seeing the new anti-racism ideas grow in influence over the last couple decades, and how he's seen those ideas affect Jewish organizations and affect people's perspectives on Jews and Israel. I also want to thank Marshall Herskovitz, who I follow on Twitter, and who is also someone interested in depolarization. Thanks for talking to me a bit on this topic.
I also read some of a book titled The Enduring, Invisible, and Ubiquitous Centrality of Whiteness, which was a series of anti-racism essays, and a couple of those essays were by Jewish people talking about their so-called whiteness and about racism. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. Remember that you can subscribe to this podcast and get ad-free episodes, amongst a few other features. But mainly, you'd be helping me work more on this podcast and helping promote it to others. So if you enjoy my work or think it's important, that's the main way you can show your appreciation. Okay, thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.